It's Tuesday, September 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hi, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, migrants and refugees in Europe are facing often confusing paths to a new life. Renewed tensions flare in Jerusalem.
We will ensure that all Australians understand that their government recognises the opportunities of the future.
Australia has a new prime minister. Also ahead, OPEC has its plan for the next year. VOA has its own music legend. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. Hungary blocked its main migrant crossing point from Serbia Monday, hours ahead of imposing tough new laws aimed at halting the massive stream of Middle East refugees headed into the country on their way to Germany and other Western European countries. Dozens of police, supported by mounted police and soldiers, stood guard on a railway track that asylum seekers had been using to cross into the European Union. VOA's Heather Murdoch has been traveling in the region and joins us by phone. Heather, where are you at the moment?
Well, right now I'm in the car driving to Budapest, having left the Hungary border with Austria. I also today crossed the border between Serbia and Hungary as well.
And what are some of the things that you've been seeing?
Well, today was a really weird day. So besides what I've actually observed, I think what's even more telling is that I'm in constant touch with a group of refugees from Syria that I came with from Turkey. As we hear on the ground, the last day before Hungary closes its border, and it's been on this trip up here a mad rush to get into Hungary before the 15th. And it's the 14th now, so my group made it. But what they did not expect was after we got to Greece ahead of this deadline, they were just bussed up immediately. They got off the boat and there were buses waiting straight across Macedonia. More buses came, or a train took them straight across Serbia. In Hungary, it was the same thing. They were welcomed across the border. The police, they walked in full view of the police and journalists, and they were put onto a train and shot across the country. What we saw on the other side towards Austria was just so strange, because as we're driving through, we see huge signs, border closed, a huge queue of people trying to go a different way because the border was closed. And then when we drove into the village where the train station was, we saw police escorting lines of silent refugees, and there was a couple of aid workers that were passing out water and blankets and stuff, and they said the police were escorting them to walk across the border, and that even though that it says the border was closed, they believed that those people were being walked across into Austria. What it appears to be is that every country wants to get the refugees out before they're the country that's behind a block.
In other words, they're trying to help them make their transit so that they don't stay there.
Right. I think I wonder if there's a bit of a feeling of that, you know, Germany has opened its doors and said their refugees are welcome. And the reaction from it was just electric. And people did make the journey and were excited to make the journey when they heard this. And I think a lot of the countries along the way are saying, well, if Germany wants to be so generous, let them.
Now, the group of Syrians that you had followed and spoke with, what were their aspirations? What were their final goals in this journey?
Well, they were all determined to stick together and remain determined to stick together to Germany. And then once they're in Germany, they have different plans. Most of them consider Germany as a possibility to settle. One of the guys, his name's Omar, he is really set on moving to Sweden. Most of them, if not all of them, want to continue their education. One of the guys is ready to go to grad school. He left Syria because he was going to be forced to join the Syrian army if he stayed, and he didn't want to join that war. And some of the other guys were in the middle of their college, and they left because their towns were being bombed, and it was just really too dangerous to survive where they were. So they want to continue college. Germany is also considered a good option because apparently the tuition is affordable there.
Some very touching and poignant stories. We wish you all the best and safe travels as you move around.
Thank you so much.
Well, time now to check out reactions on Twitter about the refugee crisis in Europe. Following social media for International Edition is our own G. Abby Lee, who is here in Studio 22. Welcome, G. What's the latest?
Hi, Jim. I've been following tweets from our own Aisha Tanzim, and as you know, she has been tweeting photos and updates from the Hungarian border. You can find her on Twitter at atanzeem, that's A-T-A-N-Z-E-E-M. You can also search for other tweets from our VOA correspondents on location by using the hashtag VOA Alert. Aisha's latest tweet reads like this: migrants waiting at Roskilde train station. Some are told the trains are going to the Austrian border.
Well, that hashtag VOA Alert, by the way, is great for our audience to keep in mind. Gee, mm-hmm. You mentioned the UNHCR account yesterday. Has it been active on Twitter today as well?
Oh, absolutely. The UN Refugee Agency, at Refugees on Twitter, has been tweeting and retweeting a lot on the situation in Hungary, among other places. One tweet that's getting a lot of attention is a picture of a one-month-old Amar from Syria who was born on the road. That photo has been retweeted more than 140 times and marked as a favorite more than 100 times. Jim, one of the most shared tweets on the refugee crisis is by the president of the EU Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker. Juncker tweeted Sunday night that he spoke with German Chancellor Angela Merkel and agreed to keep the EU borders open and to pursue solidarity in managing refugee crisis. That tweet has been retweeted more than 600 times. He's on Twitter at JunckerEU, that's JunckerEU. Jim?
Oh, thank you as always, G. Abby Lee. And don't forget to follow her on Twitter as well, at G. Abby Lee, JeeAbbeyLee. This is VOA.
If you doubt the speed at which the world is changing, just take a look at the digital media. In the last 20 years, the introduction of mobile and internet technology has spawned breathtaking advances in the sharing of information and commerce. Today, an estimated one quarter of the Earth's population uses the services of the internet. Two-thirds of us now own a mobile phone. But these advances into the digital age have been met with problems. Problems like state censorship, hackers, and identity theft, to name just a few. The Voice of America wants to know how the digital world has transformed your life. Or have they? We'd like you to tell us your story by writing or sending videos to our website, Twitter, or Facebook page. Find out more by visiting us at our webpage at voanews.com and then click on Digital Frontier. Tell your story and share it with the world through VOA's Digital Frontier.
This is VOA's International Edition. There are renewed tensions in Jerusalem amid a second day of clashes at the Al-Aqsa Mosque following an overnight rock-throwing incident that killed the driver of a vehicle returning from a meal marking the Jewish New Year, Rosh Hashanah. Regional analyst Michael Fishbach of Randolph-Macon College in Virginia told VOA's Victor Beatty that tensions have been high since a Palestinian family was killed in a firebombing of two West Bank homes by suspected Jewish settlers in July.
From the Palestinian side, there's been a considerable amount of rage, particularly among West Bank Palestinians, and that would in the occupied territories, and that would include East Jerusalem, over the deaths, the burning deaths of a family that occurred as a result of an attack by Israeli settlers a number of weeks ago. There was an infant who was burned and killed almost immediately. The father lingered on for about a week or two, and just in the past week, the mother, after lingering in the hospital for a number of weeks, finally died. For Palestinians, emotions and political feelings have been particularly high. And so coinciding with it did, as Jews flock into Jerusalem for the Jewish holidays, it's unfortunately not a surprise that this occurred when it did.
There are some in Israel who want Jews to be allowed to pray there, but apparently now they're not allowed to.
No, since 1967, that's been the case. There are two dimensions to that. The one is that for ultra-religious Jews, it is forbidden to go anywhere on that complex because they believe that somewhere on that complex, which now houses the Al-Aqsa Mosque, as well as a shrine, a very beautiful shrine known as the Dome of the Rock, that somewhere in that esplanade is where the Hebrew Temple stood 2,000 years ago. And somewhere within that temple complex is where the Holy of Holies stood, which is where the actual presence of God was. So for religious Jews, it is forbidden to go up there because you might accidentally step on the Holy of Holies. On the other hand, you have the Israeli government trying to limit political problems over Jews trying to pray there because there's a great fear among Muslim Palestinians that someday they intend to demolish those shrines and mosques and rebuild the Jewish temple.
Fischbach says as U.S. peace efforts over the past four decades have failed, absence of some incentive for both sides to reach a deal, an agreement will likely remain elusive. Australia has a new prime minister designate after Tony Abbott was ousted in a party room rebellion led by former communications minister Malcolm Turnbull. From Sydney, we hear more from Phil Mercer.
Australia's brutal political culture has another victim. Tony Abbott's prime ministership has fallen apart because he lost the trust of the electorate and ultimately the governing Liberal Party. But he met his match in Malcolm Turnbull. The former communications minister made a fortune as a merchant banker before entering Parliament and said the government had no chance of winning an election with Tony Abbott as prime minister. Turnbull used his first press conference to outline his upbeat economic vision for the country. He said his government would seek to persuade, not lecture, the electorate.
We will ensure that all Australians understand that their government recognises the opportunities of the future and is putting in place the policies and the plans to enable them to take advantage of it.
Analysts say Turnbull will be expected to take a more active stance on climate change and gay marriage than his Conservative predecessor. Australian voters aren't due to go to the polls until next year, but will it give the new man in charge enough time to heal a divided party? Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
OPEC says the world will be wanting more of its oil next year as prices continue to drop and gasoline prices slide downward. We check in with our economic correspondent in New York, Alexis Christophorus. Could OPEC be right in the sense that lower prices will entice more buying and create demand?
The oil cartel is sticking to its view that a strategy of letting prices fall will tame the U.S. shale boom and cut a global surplus. The monthly report from the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries also said a weaker outlook for China would contribute to slower global oil demand growth next year. So OPEC is predicting that non-OPEC output will slump by 110,000 barrels a day next year. Remember last week, the International Energy Agency forecast an even steeper plunge of 500,000 barrels a day by 2016. So as it becomes clear the OPEC countries are not going to cut production to ease the oversupply of oil, U.S. shale producers have begun to scale back. And we saw the West Texas Intermediate contract settle at $44 a barrel, down 63 cents on the day. It's above the six-year low of about $39 a barrel we saw last month, but it is still well below the $60 level producers had hoped for in the second half of the year. Also, we've got that plunge in gas prices, down about 30 cents a gallon in the U.S. alone in just the past week, and more worries about demand from China, also pressuring oil prices. China's factory output grew by 6.1% in August, a disappointing number that casts doubt on the strength of its industrial activity. Jim?
While some things are perhaps weakening, Apple says that the sales of its new iPhone are off to a strong start. How are they doing?
Yeah, appears to be gangbusters. The recently announced iPhone 6S and 6S Plus is approaching another sales record for Apple. Pre-orders were made available September 12th, and the tech giant says customer reaction has been, quote, extremely positive. Apple says the company is on pace to beat last year's 10 million unit first weekend record when the new iPhones go on sale September 25th, and the shipment wait time is already as long as 4 weeks. An analyst at Piper Jaffray predicts Apple will sell 12 to 13 million iPhones during its launch weekend. And analysts say China is playing a big role in the strong start for iPhone pre-orders. They point to room for growth with Apple's 15% market share in the region and, of course, rising demand for the App Store. Jim?
Apparently, Apple's strategy is paying off. We always are paid off with our strategy of speaking with Alexis Christophorus on Things Economic. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're very kind. Thanks, Jim.
The late Willis Conover brought jazz and popular music to the world over our airwaves at VOA for more than 40 years. And now a new archive of some of his recorded programs is being made available to the public through the University of North Texas Library. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with Maristela Fustel of North Texas about the archive and its significance in the history of jazz.
First of all, how did you come to know Willis Conover, and how did the University of North Texas start to store his programs?
Well, the collection was transferred quite a bit before my time. That transfer was made in 1997. Through the Willis Conover Jazz Preservation Foundation, which was headed by Leonard Garment. And I arrived as a student at North Texas for the jazz guitar program in 2005 and started working in the music library in 2007 because it was a summer job that was quiet and air-conditioned. I quickly fell in love with library work, and that summer would have been the first time I asked somebody, who's Willis Conover, and why is his name everywhere in here?
And I understand that the collection has some of Willis's programs that include people like Louis Armstrong and Stan Getz and several other of the giants of jazz. And now it's being digitized from, they were originally recorded on ferrous oxide tape, like reel-to-reel tape. And now it's being put up digitally and it's being released to the public through the school's library, right?
Yes, the collection includes a treasure trove of interviews with jazz legends. We have Art Tatum in May of 1955. We have hours, I believe, of Louis Armstrong. We have Dave Brubeck, Kai Vinding, George Avakian. Those are among the early releases. And this came about from the almost 2,100 reels in the Conover collection through a Grammy Foundation grant that we got to digitize the most urgent preservation needs, which are the oldest tapes from about 1955 to 1969. And that's what's made it possible. And we've been able to get the first 10 online with many more to come.
And this is a unique opportunity for people. Many of these artists that Willis spoke with have passed on. And so this is a unique opportunity to hear them discuss what they do and why they did it the way they did, right?
Yes, it's an uncovered chapter in jazz history that we're incredibly excited to be finally making accessible.
There is also an effort afoot to have a stamp made for Willis from the United States Postal Service as someone who was an American pioneer or someone who was a citizen of note, right?
Yes, Willis certainly fits all of the criteria that the Citizens Stamp Advisory Committee states for eligibility to be on a stamp, having had a tremendous cultural and historical impact in so many spheres, both musical, political, you name it. And so we put out an online petition, which wound up getting over 7,000 signatures. And we got a huge help from people such as Doug Ramsey and his Rifftides blog in publicizing that this effort was going on.
And where can people go? There's a website where people can go to hear these interviews that Willis did and some of the music that he recorded live. What is that website?
The easiest thing to do is Google UNT Digital Library and then search on the site for Music Library Conover Collection. and that will give you the 10 recordings plus some of the odds and ends of documents that we've scanned over the years to be able to show people just a small sample of what's in the collection.
All right. Well, thank you very much for being with us, Maricel. I appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
I would urge you to Google Willis Conover and find out more about him. Quite a legend musically, especially in jazz circles, and of course being one of our own, one of our favorites. You've been listening to International Edition, which I hope is one of your favorites. You can always find us at voanews.com. We have a favorite director. His name is Tracy Carter. Sahrat Abu Zaid is our favorite engineer. And I'm Jim Stevenson here in Washington. We hope you enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Tensions have been on the rise in Turkey following a spate of violent incidents. On September 6th, 16 Turkish military personnel died when their convoy was attacked in southeastern Turkey. The Kurdistan Workers' Party, known as the PKK, which is designated a terrorist group by Turkey, the United States, and the European Union, claimed responsibility for the killings. On September 8th, at least 14 Turkish police officers were killed in a roadside bomb attack, also blamed on the PKK. Why this resumption of violence now? Starting in 2013, the Turkish government and the PKK engaged in discussions aimed at a peaceful resolution of their differences. The process stalled after June 2015 elections left Turkey with an interim government. In July, the PKK blamed the government for the deaths of 30 Kurdish activists at the hands of Islamic State terrorists in the Turkish town of Suruç. The PKK launched a series of attacks on Turkish police and soldiers. This sparked heavy government counterstrikes, including air attacks on PKK targets. In recent days, demonstrators have taken to the streets in Turkey, some to protest terrorism and some with political goals. Some protests turned violent. Offices of the pro-Kurdish People's Democratic Party, the HDP, have been set on fire. The headquarters of the daily newspaper Hürriyet were repeatedly attacked. Several reporters from other media outlets have been arrested for criticizing the government, and some international journalists, reportedly unpopular with the government, have been deported. The U.S. Embassy in Ankara voiced on Twitter its concern over the violent demonstrations in Turkey. Speaking to reporters in Washington, State Department spokesperson John Kirby said the United States strongly condemned the PKK's terrorist attacks, noting that they represent a deadly escalation in violence that hurts the cause of those Kurds who want to live in peace. He endorsed calls made by Turkish Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu and HDP co-chairman Selahattin Demirtas and other leaders condemning the violence and appealing for calm. Spokesperson Kirby urged Turkey to respect the media freedoms and due process protections that are enshrined in the Turkish constitution. They are, he noted, key elements in every healthy democracy. The United States, like the Turkish people themselves, Mr. Kirby said, expect Turkish authorities to uphold Turkey's core values, democratic foundations, and universally recognized fundamental freedoms.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. Thank you.